men have wasted their lives in the foolish pursuit of Hamunaptra. Most have never returned.
I think you found something.
I call it the doorway to hell.
Oh my God, it does exist.
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoys significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve to go on a madcap adventure with national treasure Omid Djalili.
Do not ask me the names of any actors in this film other than the main three.
Or ever.
Or ever.
Joining us this week is our good friend Lydia Stone. Hi, Lydia.
Hello. How are we today?
How are we today?
Well, are you having a good Friday?
It's Good Friday.
Well,
I should know this as the resident Catholic.
I had to point it out to my nominally culturally Catholic boyfriend, so that was an entertaining conversation.
I'm only Catholic by way of being Italian. I'm not.
Yeah,
I think Italian, it's Catholic until proven guilty.
Yeah, we get proven guilty very often. Let me tell you that.
All right. So this week we are talking about the 1999 adventure film The Mummy, directed by Stephen Sommers. Dashing legionnaire Rick O'Connell stumbles upon the hidden ruins of Hamunaptra while in the midst of a battle to claim the area in 1920s Egypt. It has been over 3,000 years since former high priest Imhotep suffered a fate worse than death as a punishment for a forbidden love, along with a curse that guarantees eternal doom upon the world if he is ever awoken.
I like how you pronounced Imhotep.
Isn't that not how you pronounce it?
I don't know, but I like it.
Imhotep.
Imhotep. It's getting vaguely racist.
Okay, The Mummy. What are both of your experiences with this film in the past?
Okay, so as a child, I was a big fan of the second one, the more like family friendly, you know.
The PS2 cutscene one.
The PS2 cutscene one. This one terrified me. The scene where Imhotep has got like the white adult face and he's like spewing flies and insects out of his mouth. Like, I just couldn't watch this film. Then I rewatched them both a couple of years ago as an adult back to back. Oh, this one is so good. It's so much better than the sequel. It's one of the best adventure films of its era, if not, you know, of contemporary Hollywood cinema as a whole.
How about you, Lydia?
I'd never seen it. I was sort of, well, in my youth, I was done a terrible ill by an archaeologist who was a big fan of this film. So I'd always avoided it. But I was aware of the sort of meme reputation that it has as being, along with like Thor Ragnarok and similar, a bisexual film, which I should mention, I'm a bisexual trans woman. Hello, that's what the voice is about. But
I just want to say congratulations on that.
Yeah.
Congratulations on having a very easy life.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is a privilege. but you know, I went into this film being sort of trying to look at it with that lens and find that in it. We'll see sort of what I made of that. But that's my history with it. I hadn't seen it, basically. I knew of it.
Well, here's why I think its reputation as a bisexual film is more appropriate than, you know, stuff like Marvel, if you will, Thor Ragnarok and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Because not only is every character incredibly attractive and incredibly naked, regardless of gender, they have a lot of sexual chemistry with each other. They're all very sexy. A lot of contemporary Hollywood cinema, especially if you bring up Marvel, is very asexual.
Sexless. Everyone is beautiful and no one is horny. That's the sort of paradigm with which we're working.
I genuinely can't remember what that article is, but I think that does just not just sum up Marvel, but just the state of modern blockbusters in 2020s.
I definitely agree that the sexual tension and the presence of overt sexuality in a way that isn't completely sanitized is something that's more present in slightly, and I do mean slightly older films. The Mummy's, what, 1999?
Yeah. Same year as The Matrix, which sort of is another big bisexual awakening film.
Yeah.
That's a trans awakening film.
Yeah, the Matrix is a highly, highly trans feminine film. But
we haven't done an episode on The Matrix yet. Lydia,
bring me back.
We'll keep in mind.
All right, let's just scoot back to The Mummy. Have either of you seen Tomb of the Dragon Emperor?
No.
I've not seen it either, which is a shame because I love Michelle Yeoh and I know that she's in it and it would be really fun to see her in one of these movies, but I kind of can't bring myself to watch sort of the movie that like finally put Brendan Fraser in a horrible physical pain.
And it also put the entire franchise in a tomb, as it were.
Until its triumphant return in 2017's The Mummy.
with a soundless trailer.
I forgot about that.
I think something we should talk about, obviously it's called The Mummy. What is very striking is that there's very little of the nominal antagonist of this film actually like in the bandages and wandering around like a traditional mummy. And I don't know whether that necessarily makes Imhotep, as played by Arnold Vosloo, scarier or if it just stops you from thinking of it as a Scooby-Doo film.
Well, that's the thing. He was never mummified. He was... He
was in bandages for a minute.
He was in bandages, but he wasn't alive.
Oh, no, that's right. They bandaged him up. But then when they opened the tomb, he doesn't have any bandages on him.
Yeah, I think it's...
No, he's juicy.
Is it because the Beatles
ate
away at it?
The idea was, although it wasn't very explicit in the film, that apparently this is from the novelization. The idea was that the scarabs put in his sarcophagus with him would over time very slowly eat him. And then because of his sort of magically preserved life, it eventually in desperation, he would then eat the beetles. So he's like, he's eating the Beatles are eating him. He's sort of magically preserved in this way. I'm not saying... to be clear that this makes any sense, but...
So that's how John Lennon died.
Yeah.
But
I think I read about the making of the film that they very deliberately didn't put him in bandages or shambling with his arms up around because they were trying to get away from the, you know, 1930s classic movie monster trappings of it while getting to the fact that when it came out, the original Mummy films, as the original Dracula films, as the original Frankenstein, were terrifying to people. Like the things that it turns into for whichever child it is in the novel, it one of them is a parade of movie monsters because that's what he is most afraid of. And it's really hackneyed things like, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon and a mummy that we think of because of sort of Halloween monster euphemism treadmill. We think of these things as things that children dress up as and would be in a Monster Mash video, not things that scare us to our core.
I wonder if these movies are very scary and very impactful on a younger audience if you get it to them before they're able to absorb all the pop culture around it by osmosis.
Well, in my case, this film was absolutely terrifying. Like I think something similar happened to The Mummy to what happened to Boris Karloff's Mummy. That nowadays it's to the 1999 Mummy nowadays, that its iconography has sort of aged in a way that it's not as scary anymore, especially because, you know, of its time CGI, when he just opens his mouth agape, you know.
I mean, I found that quite a lot scarier than most of the rest of the film, just the sheer uncanny valley of his long, larry ass fucking jaw.
Oh my God, have you ever seen The Mummy Returns? Because the Dwayne Johnson CGI is the single scariest thing I've ever seen.
I've seen that though.
No, but like I remember, like when he opens up his mouth, you know, like a snake. As a child, that was the single most terrifying thing I'd ever seen in my life. Nowadays, not anymore. Also because I'm no longer a child, but I wonder if children watch this film nowadays, if they would still find this scary.
Do you think the CGI still broadly holds up?
I think it does. There's a couple of scenes that were a bit PS2 cutscenes, like...
The water's the big one.
The water, when the ghost carriage comes at the end and takes his soul away, that was a bit... But anything concerning Imhotep himself and his model, that, I mean, you can see it's fake, but it still works.
It's not a matter of being realistic to the point that you can mistake it for prosthetics. It's about it being faithful and authentic enough that the story is still effective.
And I repeat, The Mummy Returns, where Dwayne Johnson, his entire face is in CGI. It's horrible. It looks terrible.
And I mean, you know, I think we, it's easy to cringe at that sort of thing kind of immediately after the fact. But I think it's just reaching the age now where it'll have the thing that happens with vinyl records and the static of VHSs and all of that happen, where the trappings and the things we regard as flaws about a medium or a form of storage will become the things that are most loved and remembered about it.
Yeah, it makes it charming in a way.
It does, yeah. It's very late 90s CGI, and that's a thing that we can't really make anymore, and certainly no one's trying.
I mean, we could, but...
Yeah.
It'd be a great idea.
But I also think that in this case, the CGI is being used to augment what is literally there, either in terms of the actors or in terms of prosthetics. And I think even to this day, even with the best CGI, my favourite use of CGI are when they are used to do something that couldn't be made practically.
Yeah.
Rather than as a substitute for a practical and tangible reality.
Mm-hmm. And I think you can imagine a version of this film that comes out even 10 years prior, and The Mummy is entirely terrifying prosthetics, and it would be a very different film.
I think it would be a less successful film if The Mummy was... I think The Mummy is scary enough to be a threat and to be a thorn in the side of the main characters. I mean, to what we were saying earlier, comparing it to the Universal movie, this isn't a horror movie.
It's Indiana Jones.
Exactly. It's an adventure movie with a scary villain.
And it's got that blend of action-oriented, but also funny, quippy one-linery without... ever feeling annoying because of it. You know, it predates the era of Whedonisms that we've gotten so used to. And it's actually really, really funny.
I think I might have been negatively influenced in my viewing of this film by the fact that I've been a little under the weather recently. So I've literally just finished a massive catch-up and rewatch of the entire Hate Me MCU. By the end of it, I was so fucking tired of light entertainment, action, mild comedy, adventure films of the like mono genre, that I really got bored of The Mummy.
I mean, there's some things about it that maybe strike you as it is doing something similar to Marvel, but it's doing it better than some more recent Marvel films have been doing it.
Very possibly. It's hard to compare in that just the material conditions of the market are so different that created the mummy to the ones that created the MCU. And the MCU exists in a world where the MCU exists, whereas the Mummy didn't, but now it has to. You know, if I'm gonna have a really bland kind of fun movie, we're now used to that having an obscene level of polish, and I think that's probably a bad thing.
You didn't just call The Mummy bland, did you?
I watching it was hard to feel it was in any way different from a knockoff of Indiana Jones. Rick felt like he had absolutely nothing to do. And we know he can act because I just watched him do so in a better film for this podcast. But
I can't wait to talk about Gods and Monsters.
Well, this week I've watched back-to-back The Mummy, Gods and Monsters, and The Whale. And let me tell you, that was a ride. Mm. I think that, I don't know, I think this film is very fun. And it might be considered bland in a way that, it doesn't really break the mold of the, you know, Hollywood action movie, adventure movie formula. But I do think that it maybe doesn't perfect it, but it does a really good job at everything, you know, all of the slots it fits into them very well. Mm. But I'm fanboying about this film way too much, and it's good to have. And I think that, I don't know, this film is, it's got a lot of fans, and I worry that we're talking a bit too much about it, how it compares to Marvel or it compares to contemporary blockbusters. But it is kind of like watching it nowadays. It feels like the last bastion of a bygone era. And
it does.
It's interesting
to, like,
compare.
It feels like the last 20th century movie they ever made. Yeah, like the last bastion of bygone era. It feels like everything that would come after would get worse and worse and worse.
Including sequels to this movie.
Most of which were different people, as I gather. Yeah, it does seem like, as much as I didn't necessarily get on with it, and as much as there are things in it that may have been done better by other films of its time, I do also wish there were more films like it. Even if I didn't like it, I wish more films had the room to be just cute and fun and...
And sexy as well. Like, let's not
forget
how horny this film is. And I think it's a huge point in its favour.
Brendan Fraser is an obscenely beautiful man.
I think, to his credit, it's maybe the last time, or it's drawing to the end of the period in which I know technically it's sort of a remake of the Universal Mummy movie, but a relatively original film not tied to a franchise in that obvious a way that we get now, starring two British actors who are respected but not megastars, and Brendan Fraser maybe at the height of his fame post George of the Jungle, but when you look at like the other names that were considered for this, and is the obvious ones like Matt Damon, Tom Cruise, who would obviously star in the remake, Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, even Matthew McConaughey. So they did try to go for like a bigger tentpole star, but the fact that this movie can have someone that is, and I mean, there's no disrespect to Brendan Fraser, but sort of the lowest rung at this point on the A-list is a real achievement, and that it can be this level of success and get that many people to A, go and see it, and B, and I think this is where it's sort of longevity comes from, is in VHS sales and the fact that people this is a very
that's a huge part of the reputation that this film has. I have to assume
it's a sleepover movie.
Yeah, a lot of the current wave, particularly because I remember this not being talked about as a film for a really long time, and then starting to be talked about quite a lot as kids who had the VHS of it became adults with social media accounts.
And everyone was like, oh, that's where I had my sexual awakening.
Exactly,
You're both obsessed with this idea.
Well, but that's... honestly, I'm pretty sure it was a couple of years ago. You couldn't go on Twitter, you couldn't go anywhere without people reposting the same picture with the cast from The Mummy Returns, all naked. Yeah. Also because, like, they're all naked the whole time. And everyone was like, oh, so that's where I had my sexual awakening. Because those are people, you know, in their 20s who are now, as you said, they are revisiting it.
So you're saying people realized they were gay because of John Hannah?
I don't think it's John Hannah.
I think he is the secret source of this movie. And I think he is a very attractive man. And I defy you to tell me otherwise.
He's just not very naked in this film. So I think it's mostly...
And he's a comedy fruit in this film. He's not a sexual awakening fruit, which crucially...
But, he's a romantic awakening.
Yeah, absolutely.
Will make that.
But you want him to be your boyfriend? Is that what you guys are saying? You want John Hannah in this movie?
With his janky English accent.
I slips into Scottish.
The thing is, I saw Spartacus Blood and Sand, which he is like one of the leads in the first series of, before I saw this. I watched it and thought, oh my God, it's a guy from Spartacus. And like, my ins to this movie weren't Rachel Weisz, weren't Brendan Fraser. It was Omid Djalili, who plays the...
His first film role? His film debut?
I think so, yeah. He plays the prison warden.
Oh, I see.
Who hates bugs.
The stinky warden, who they describe at more than one point. I'm just saying, I don't know about this movie.
It's, his portrayal of Egyptians is less than favourable.
No, there's the cool guys with, what are they called, the mysterious guys?
The Magi. That's a real slice of life of 1920s Egypt.
But yeah, no, this
and very much everyone's focus of the film.
I think this film hates Americans more so than it hates Egyptians.
That's true.
And at what point in her career was Rachel Weisz when she made this?
I think she'd done British stuff, and she had to audition a bunch of times for it, which sort of implies that she wasn't massively on Universal's radar at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the three of them work really well. I think something that makes their dynamic so enjoyable to me is that you don't have the ordinary, you know, whether it's Han Solo and Princess Leia or Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn, or the sort of reckless scoundrel and the uptight woman butting heads all the time. What you have is two people who are very attractive and very attracted to each other, bonding over the fact that the woman's brother is fucking useless. The fact that you have the annoying
Think it's almost exactly Star Wars. It's just that Luke...
They don't know, because they don't know it's the brother at that point.
Yeah.
The thing that I think separates her from characters that are similar is like the bookish woman who turns out to be sexy despite the initial appearance is that And I mean this not in a crude way, but Rachel Weisz as Evelyn is into freaky stuff. And I don't mean like in a sexual way, but that's sort of implied. But like, she's into goo.
Academically, yeah.
She's into gunk.
Yeah, and it's not like she shows up as a nerdy librarian and then she has a makeover and becomes sexy. She's sexy from the get-go.
Yeah, it's never like, huh. I bet you don't think a woman with glasses can be sexy.
No.
He's like, no, she's sexy. she's Rachel Weisz.
And she's got that amazing moment where she's like, I may not be an adventurer. I may not be a treasure hunter, but I'm proud of what I am. Yeah, a librarian.
A librarian.
I think Rachel Weisz is... I actually would love to change Lydia's mind on this. I think she's cool in this movie. And I think that the fact that she knows exactly what her role is and isn't trying to, like... It's not the boys being stupid and the girl has to be the buzzkill. She is also an idiot in a lot of ways.
But she's the one who resurrects Timothy by mistake.
Like, yeah, but not in the way that like an Indiana Jones woman would.
Yeah.
Would like do it by accident. Yeah. Like go off screen. And yeah, she does screams, but it's like, oh, this is an accident. And now they have to team up to do it together. It's not Brendan Fraser fixing her mistakes.
Yeah, but also it's because of her curiosity. Mm. Like, she's got this book and she's a scholar. She wants to read it. And, you know, she does. It's not because she's stupid.
No, I think she's cool.
I don't know about the plaque.
Oh, the eyebrows are bad, but they're also period accurate, unfortunately.
I feel like we've all looked into what was going on with her eyebrows. I don't know if it's a late 90s thing, but it is definitely...
It was also 1920s.
No, I know it's a 1920s thing, but I think it also...
It was a 20s thing and a noughties thing.
It crosses over with the style of the late 90s.
Yeah.
But she doesn't do it again in the sequels. And I wonder if that's... Not because in real life that wasn't the fashion. I wonder if it was because everyone who watched the movie was going, I really like that movie. Rachel Weisz is really hot. Yeah, like, what's up with her eyebrows? Should we talk availability, but then move on to Gods and Monsters? All right. You can rent this movie on Amazon, Google Play, YouTube, Microsoft, Rakuten TV.
There you go.
And Apple TV, and you can buy it on all the same channels.
Mm-hmm. Shall we move on to our next film?
Yes. Play the trailer.
Man's going to make up his life alone.
A philosopher.
Thoreau. With a lawnmower.
Do you believe people come into our lives for a purpose?
To a new world of gods and monsters.
So, we understand each other.
Live and let live.
Gods and Monsters, a 1998 film directed by Bill Condon. Plot is, it's 1957, and James Whale's heyday as the director of Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and The Invisible Man is long behind him. Retired and a semi-recluse, he lives his days accompanied only by images from his past. When his dour housekeeper, Hannah, hires Clayton, a handsome young gardener, the flamboyant director and simple yardman develop an unlikely friendship which will change them forever.
So, that's a shit synopsis of this movie. I'm sorry. It's mean to Hannah. It's mean to Lynn Redgrave.
And it's... anyway.
It changes them forever. I mean, kind of?
Well,
not for fucking long it doesn't.
Yeah. But this film, obviously, on paper, what the fuck has it got to do with The Mummy? It's not an adventure movie. It's not an action movie. Genre-wise, it's completely separate. But we have some very interesting similarities. One, it's got Brendan Fraser in one of his best performances of the 90s. Two, it's gay. Three, it's about Universal Monsters. And it's got, obviously, a lot of visual references to the original Frankenstein. And finally, something I didn't even realize until recently, the protagonist is called Whale, which is the same name as the film for which Brendan Fraser recently won the Oscar. So that's a link for you right there.
Yeah, well, the thing about The Whale is it's a very sympathetic portrayal of an obese man, but at the same time, is called The Whale.
It's
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with the obese protagonist. The Whale is about Moby Dick, And anything that associates Darren Aronofsky calling a fat man a whale is totally disingenuous and uncalled for.
Well, you that's where you're wrong. Darren Aronofsky didn't write the screenplay. It's based on a play.
I don't give a shit. He still made the fucking movie. Yeah. I hate that movie.
So there is an aura of uncomfortableness around this film, I would say, because, you know, it's portraying James Whale as this aging...
Borderline predatory
gay man. And
which, as far as we know, is not true of the historical James Whale, which is a bit doing him dirty.
Well, this is based on a book
It's based on a novel rather than like a memoir.
A lot of it came from his partner, David, who does appear in the film as well. Mm. But, you know, there is obviously this sort of uncomfortableness with the fact that later on in his career, Brendan Fraser went through similar experiences as his character does in this film, being sexually harassed and assaulted by older Hollywood executives. But I think that if you divorce it from its relations to any real life stories, be it James Whale's or Brendan Fraser's, it's a really, really interesting film. It's a really interesting
portrayal
of a traumatized, broken man suffering with PTSD who uses sexuality almost as an outlet for his trauma. And his relationship with Fraser, which, as the synopsis suggests, will change them permanently, is
both an overstatement and an understatement.
Yeah.
Oh, but how good. I thought this film was really, really good.
I think this is, and I don't mean this like in a bad way about the film, I think this is a perfectly good film with two career best performances from its leads.
Are you saying this is a career best for Ian McKellen?
Yes.
Oh, wow, that's a high bar.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I don't know what else you'd choose.
That's true, because like,
probably something in theatre. I think
career best screen performance.
I've
seen Ian McKellen twice on stage.
What did you see him in?
I saw him, I think this was the first year I moved in London. I saw him with Patrick Stewart doing Harold Pinter's No Man's Land.
Oh, I saw that too. Yeah. That was a
really
great performance.
That was really good.
I saw him in Godot, but it was after Patrick Stewart wasn't in it anymore. It was other people.
I've seen clips from that performance because they did that in rep with No Man's Land, but then when it came back to the UK, they only did No Man's Land.
And yeah, he's an amazing actor, and from what I know of him, an amazing person.
Yeah, you know, he has, honestly, I mean, he's got so many skills, but he does just have the most wonderful voice.
And also, like, can we just appreciate the fact that a biopic from the 90s about a gay man actually has a gay actor playing him?
Yeah.
That's true.
You don't see that often.
But to what I was saying, like, I think this is, as a film, it has some like interesting flourishes that make it interesting, but by and large, it is a pretty by the numbers story about a famous person and a stranger that comes into their life. I don't think the screenplay is that good. I think it's elevated by two genuinely sublime performances. And I just want to actually call back to something I said on our Oscars episode. And I said something about Brendan Fraser that I want to walk back in the comparing him to Colin Farrell. If he won the Whale as a career Oscar for all the performances he gave that never got Academy Awards attention, that didn't make sense to me because I couldn't at the time think of a film that he was snubbed for and really deserved to win. Well, except for George. I haven't seen that in a very long time, so I may be wrong. But genuinely watching this film, not only was I blown away by his performance in this and how like tough and sensitive it was at the same time without it being a stereotype, but also how only Brendan Fraser could have played it.
Well, he's so perfectly cast.
Yeah.
There is almost an air of James Whale's attraction to him being due to some form of resemblance to Boris Karloff.
Yeah, he's got a big flat Frankenstein head.
Well, the way they cut his hair to also he's got, you know, this very square jaw and he's very tall. But there's a scene quite late in the film which is kind of a recreation of, you know, the style of the original Frankenstein, where you see the two of them in a black and white screen walking past the background in silhouette. Mm. And then they come into the light and you can see their, you know, faces. And I was surprised to see Brendan Fraser there. I was expecting to see Frankenstein's monster when I saw the silhouette of his body.
I think the other thing that I really appreciate about this film, and I know I said that for me it's all about performances, but something I did also appreciate is the fact that it doesn't make James Whale into some sort of tragic victim of a compulsory heteronormative structure.
No, because as far as I can tell, that wasn't the case.
No.
Historically, it was sort of other things and other factors that led to the end of his career.
And to be honest, it's also very... I mean, there's an argument to say how brave it is to show a gay man being this flawed, but to make your central character that the film is revolving around so complicated and at times morally dubious, I think that's a really smart and brave move. And I think Ian McKellen manages to play the sort of vulnerable and terrified, but also slightly predatory and an abusive side.
Well, and there is an air of that being self-destructive, because he knows that if he pushes his boundaries, especially back in the 1950s, with someone like Brendan Fraser, like a straight ex-military man, that this guy might turn violent on him. And we do get the sense that he might actually be trying to push that exact boundary. Whereas early on, when he flirts, when he does basically the same things with that obviously gay reporter, it's a bit more coy.
I would say that I interpret that as part of the same. I don't think they're separate. I think that on the one hand, he is sort of forcing himself into another stroke at the beginning, and is at the very beginning of the film. Mm. He is essentially playing a sort of strip poker with his interviewer that eventually gives him a stroke because he can't handle the arousal. Mm-hmm. And we're led to believe this is a very intelligent man who is very concerned with his own mortality. I read that decision early on in the film to be actually deliberate rather than, oh, this old gay man can't even do it anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it was much more calculated in, you know, to put it crudely, this is the way I want to go.
Yeah.
I think you see that death wish from the beginning is my
point.
It's
an interesting contrast from the what I know of the book. I just read a synopsis of the novel, Father of Frankenstein, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, by Christopher Bram.
Yeah. And so in the film, the sort of whale is sort of sexually predatory to Clayton Boone, which is Fraser's character. With the explicit motive that is because he wants to die and he wants to be killed. In the film, it sort of obscures the fact that in the source material, he wants his death to have a human face. And he wants it to be, you know, he wants to have a reason to die and a circumstance of death that is something other than his illness. And he wants that to be this, you know, beautiful man that he's formed a friendship with. And obviously the circumstances he's going about that are pretty rancid, but, you know, that's the point. Whereas in the film, it's made a lot more alienating and it's made a lot sort of weirder, and Whale puts Clayton in this World War One gas mask that, you know, takes his human face away, literally.
Mm.
Which
It turns him into a monster.
Yeah, which is getting at something very different. And I've got to say, I absolutely loved this film. I thought it was beautiful. And it, very similar to you, Charlie, in that I think most of that was the performances of the two leads. But I think it did stumble into some sort of interesting subject matter, even if accidentally, in the way it's talking about queer masculinity and just the portrayal of the main character. But it sort of did the same thing for me that The History Boys does. Play and then film about a class of, well, A-level or whatever the equivalent was, history students hoping to get into Oxbridge. And they have two teachers, one who's very sort of old-fashioned and romantic and wants to educate them, and one who is about trying to get them to pass exams and get into university. And
early film performance of James Corden, by the way.
Yeah, among many others.
Yeah. Well, it's a brilliant cast, but it is just interesting. Oh, James Corden's an actor. Irritation.
But in the play and the film, the teacher, Hector, who's this sensitive, romantic, sort of literary type, is also, quote unquote, mildly molesting the boys. He's groping the boys. And it really doesn't feel like the play or the film want you to really hate him for it. It feels like, more than anything else, that's done to make him pathetic, as in literally the subject of pathos, which is a really weird way to go about it.
Well, if anything, it reminds me of Death in Venice, again, the novella and then the film. I don't know if
I know of it, but not
it's,
much.
Yeah, like very similar vibes. Or Tár.
Yeah. Which,
you know, Lydia Tár was unjustly maligned and...
we will defend her to the death.
Career, but yeah.
can I just make a point about History Boys that then I will talk about Gods and Monsters? I think Richard Griffith's character in History Boys and James Whale in Gods and Monsters, yes, the way they behave is definitely objectively inappropriate. However, unlike in a lot of the cases in real life and unlike a lot of films, they never hold all of the power. Because you see that in those ones, the reason why it's sort of framed as acceptable is that it allows them to be extremely vulnerable and, in the case of the History Boys, pliable from their younger subjects of their adoration. And maybe there's an argument to be had about whether that's irresponsible portrayal. Maybe it is in History Boys. I don't think it is in Gods and Monsters. But I think that the power dynamics is what informs it rather than the behavior itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's an intensely thorny thing to wrap your head around. And, you know, the History Boys is among my favorite films just because I reliably cry at anything about the power of education. But
I really don't like, you know, the film. I think it's a great play. I don't think the film's particularly good.
I'd feel the same about a pro shot of the play. But then again, I'm not a film bitch.
But again, another
You're a film whore.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas we, as hosts of a podcast, we're film pimps. But before we move on, something that I was curious about is how clueless do you think Boone actually is? Because I know he acts caught off guard in a lot of the film, but how knowing and how understanding of what's going on is Boone in those scenes? And also, how do you think Fraser is playing it? I'm interested to see what you guys think.
I do think there's a potential for him to be clueless if you consider that there's a straight white man in the 1950s, probably living, you know, in an environment where there's a lot of compulsive heterosexuality. It doesn't come from the same world as the Hollywood Reporter, which is a bit more liberal and libertine. Like, you just don't meet any out gay people. So you just assume that people around you are straight unless they tell you otherwise, or unless, you know, they explicitly prove that they aren't. And I think his friends at the bar are shown to be a bit more knowing, but he's also like probably trying to shield himself from the thought that this, you know, that his employer might be trying to flirt with him by just, you know, dismissing that thought.
What do you think, Lydia?
I think it's less that he's completely clueless and more that he is getting something different out of the interaction and out of the relationship than Whale is. You know, in that I believe him at face value when he says he's straight. I don't think there is a sexual component to it.
No, I think he's definitely straight. I don't think it's a secret.
But he is also willing, even knowing that Whale is a gay man, that Whale is a gay man who wants to draw him nude, he is towards the end willing to not acquiesce to that, but willing to participate in it for his own feelings. And it's not for, you know, sexual gratification, but it's for being subject to an adoring gaze from an adoring gay.
But also for that pathos that you were talking about, he wants to help his friend who he knows doesn't have much longer to live. And there's one thing they can offer him. And, you know, he probably trusts Whale not to take it too far as well.
It's sort of an act of radical kindness in a way.
Yeah,
and they say explicitly that Boone trusts Whale and that Whale knows that Boone trusts them. And it's precisely knowing that trust exists that enables him to then violate that for his own purposes.
The last thing I'd like to say about this, and it ties into what you guys were saying about this, you know, it's not unreasonable for a straight white guy who also, like, isn't from LA. He's from Missouri, I think.
Yeah.
In the 1950s specifically, to be that clueless. And something that I really appreciate about the film, and it's also something that I really like about the film Babylon, which not a lot of people have seen, but everyone should because it's amazing and it isn't too long. And if anything, it's too short. It's that in the 1920s and 30s, things were, it's not like we have been, we started at a place of absolute intolerance and over time got to liberalism. In the 1920s and 30s, people were much more understanding about queerness and unconventional relationships and identities than they were in the McCarthyite 1950s.
Yeah, I wonder what happened between those dates.
I really appreciate the film pointing out the fact that the 1950s shown in this is a digression from the path towards progressivism rather than a necessary point in something that was a straight line from intolerance to tolerance.
Yeah.
Not least because it includes George Cukor, who was maybe the closest thing to an out gay man that you could have at that time and didn't particularly try hard to hide it. In our first episode, I said I was a fan of George Cukor, and I was very excited when they mentioned him, but they mentioned him as sort of this antagonistic figure to Whale, and then you see him, he's actually quite nice.
Yeah.
Whale
is very, very clearly a bitter old queen.
And I love that. And when you actually see the people who are the sort of the subjects of his ire or disdain, they're not that bad, and it's kind of all in his head that he says he's fine with it, and he left the movie industry on not particularly bitter terms, but it's in his head, and he still clearly has a lot of chips on his shoulders.
It's like the old saying, if you dislike every person, or if you have beef with every person around you, maybe the problem is with you, it's not with them.
Is there anything else? Should we go to availability?
No, we should go to availability.
All right, availability. You can stream this on Prime Video, you can rent it on Amazon, Google Play, YouTube, and Apple TV, and you can buy it on all those channels as well. So, speaking of films, let's talk about the next one.
One of the movies of all time.
This is one of the most films of all time.
It actually is.
Certainly one of the films that there are.
Play the trailer.
Fine.
Hey, I'm Trish.
Hi, Trish.
Well, what do men want?
Just a pretty woman to love and to take care of them.
Love me. Love me.
What I'm really interested in is love. You might say I'm addicted to love.
Witchcraft is just a way of concentrating energy. Can only work with what's already there.
Okay, The Love Witch, directed by Anna Biller. Elaine, a beautiful young witch, is determined to find a man to love her. In her gothic Victorian apartment, she makes spells and potions and then picks up men and seduces them. However, her spells work too well, and she ends up with a string of hapless victims. I really like this movie.
You know what? I bet I could fix her.
Yeah. I like her. And you know what? If I was involved, it wouldn't have gone down like that.
No,
like Mark Wahlberg on that flight.
But this film is so good. I was surprised because I started watching it, having forgotten all the info I'd read about it. And then I was surprised when halfway through I just switched tabs and I saw it was from 2016. Because the way it recreates the 70s aesthetics is like bang on the money. Like it looks like a 70s film. It sounds like a 70s film. It feels like a 70s film.
Yeah, I think it is perfectly recreated in 2016, despite, you know, being a film made with the legacy of every film since the 70s. Mm-hmm. No, I think it's great, and it's clearly like a real labor of love to sort of realize that vision, and everything from the production design to the brilliant, brilliant performances that do sort of capture that pre-naturalism vibe of not old Hollywood, but that sort of middle period in like the late 60s and early 70s where we were still sort of figuring it out.
It's very B-movie-ish as well.
Yeah, which, you know, I love. And, you know, we've talked about Suspiria in this podcast. There's clearly big Suspiria vibes going on in this film. I really liked it. And I suppose the reason I picked it is because I knew I wanted a monster movie that was directed by a woman. And this isn't strictly a monster movie, but I think to tie it in with The Mummy, what it does evoke an earlier monster genre.
Yeah, it's looking back. And I think that's the theme with everything going on here is conversation with the past and the past of cinema in specific.
I think this more directly critiques the films it's trying to evoke than The Mummy does with the 1930s mummy than Gods and Monsters necessarily does with Frankenstein. And
yeah, I think the conversation the mummy is having with the past is talking over it and hoping you don't notice that the past is there.
And that the past is a tiny bit goofy.
Yeah. I thought this film was real interesting. In large part for how... There's style and substance going on here, and they are talking to each other, but the style is a lot better than the substance.
Interesting.
I think I nearly raised a point in this film because I had heard it said that the director, Annabella, was a TERF, was a transphobe.
Oh, really?
I've heard that critique of the film, but not. I hadn't heard it of the director.
Yeah, I've heard it said of her for a few years, and I thought, okay, maybe let's Google this and see if this is just like a rank screed of a film and I need to like raise it as an issue. And then the first thing that came up when I started Googling it was a tweet in the way of a review from Gretchen Falcon-Martin, who is a trans woman and an author and horror type, who tweeted... The Love Witch rules because it was directed by someone who is completely cuckoo bananas about femininity and womanhood. Her behavior since is completely in line with that derangement. And I thought, sounds like my shit, to be honest. Like,
Did you find out if Annabella was a TERF?
I mean, she's not like a late stage Linehan TERF if she is, but like, she seems that. And she's certainly got a few interesting opinions on unrelated things. She's a satanic panic truther, which is a bit random.
What's a satanic truther?
So she believed that the satanic ritual abuse was happening.
Okay.
This film is unexpectedly anti-satanic or anti-witchcraft.
You don't quite like... I haven't read anything about the director. I didn't quite know what to make of this film because it does have a lot of points that smell very much like second wave feminism, completion of gender and sex.
There's two types of like TERF art or transphobic art, and one of them is the like late stage, it's all you can think about, you just hate them so much shit, and the other is like the embryonic kind of second wave feminist, it's entirely about a female body
sexuality. Reduction of womanhood to a purely physical aspect. But I didn't know how much of that was the ideology of the director or how much of that was... Well, one is aping the 1970s aesthetics, you know, the era and of second wave.
And also 1960s philosophy.
Yeah, and, you know, two, the characters, because, you know, the character is expressing a certain ideal, doesn't necessarily mean that the director does. No. But then... A lot of the characters expressing these ideas are witches, and now you're telling me that the director doesn't like witches, so does she agree or disagree with them?
So I have sort of thoughts on this as a whole. I think maybe I say it's a critique of witchcraft, which kind of is, but I think it's more scathing a critique of the sort of shallowness of the 1960s free love movement.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other shit she says in public is very pro-witchcraft, to be clear. That's not the main...
but
there's a distinction between witchcraft and Satan.
Yeah, come on!
but the male cult leader in this film is subtly shown to be an abuser.
Yeah. Mm.
And using the sort of shallow language of female liberation and feminine power through sexuality as a means to seduce young women.
And that's also the thing, the main character, the love witch, she's got an incredibly conservative view of womanhood. She basically wants to be a trad wife.
Absolutely.
Like, it's very it's very funny when she calls the guy who she has used a spell to fall madly in love with her a pussy. But it's also very jarring.
Yeah.
Because you kind of go into it thinking this is going to be like, you know, I don't want to throw around the word, you know, girl boss movie. But I kind of thought that's sort of the energy it had, but it is much more about saying that, no, it's not about, feminism isn't about individual power, it's about equality, which isn't what Elaine is concerned with in this film. The other thing is that if you have any problems with the director, it is worth pointing out this is a film where there is such a gulf between author's intent and the general reception. I think she is, the director is very embarrassed by the fact that a lot of people sort of view this film as camp or view this film
Wikipedia
as funny.
Calls this a comedy horror, and it wasn't supposed to be.
No.
What?
Yes.
It was meant to be like a very scathing.
It was so serious, and you can tell how serious it's supposed to be.
That's what makes it funny.
What? You're blowing my mind. I thought
it's played completely straight because she thought she was making like a serious. It's an aping of something that has since been interpreted as camp, but she didn't set out to make a comedy or something that people could, you know, celebrate and have a good time with.
But there are so many things that are clearly punchlines. Like there are a lot of jokes at the expenses of men.
Yeah.
You know, capital M men, and there's an inner monologue by the protagonist where one of the lines that she says, and this is one of those monologues that is very like second wave feminist of like women are defined by their internal biology, but she has this line where she says, you know, most men have never even seen a tampon, and then later on where she makes that little fetish jar with urine and a tampon in it, and a cop finds it, and the two male cops look at it and they're like, what is this? I don't know. I thought that was really funny.
It's really funny. I can so see how you could think this film was funny on purpose, because I couldn't get a read on it for a lot of watching it. I was like, is this bad or am I stupid? You know, like, is this really bad or am I just sort of, do I just not get it? And I think it might be both, because this film, if you feel like you don't get this film, it will stop to explain itself to you multiple times within one viewing. Like it's one of the most obvious films about what it's saying to you, while at the same time being very ideologically incoherent for something that is like constantly just Ayn Randing ideology at you.
I thought it was really good, but that was probably because of the stuff that I was projecting onto it.
The style is incredible.
I found good about it. Probably the filmmakers would disagree with me on them. So yeah,
I think I liked this more than both of you. What, at least the way I interpreted it, it was that the thesis it was seemed to be saying was that the sort of the narrative of empowerment through self-objectification is ultimately a self-defeating endeavor. It's that by saying that if I control the way I'm objectified, then I can be powerful, when in reality you're just contributing to the objectification.
And as a thesis in and of itself, I think that's true. That's fair enough. It's sort of what the implication of the like corollaries and the conclusions from that are.
Because watching it, I thought that the critique of the protagonist wasn't that she's hypersexual, but that she's using her hypersexuality almost in a as a service to maintaining a patriarchal structure. Sorry?
She's hurting other women by doing this.
She absolutely is. And I thought
poor
that,
Trish.
Yeah.
Poor gay Trish.
Oh, you're so beautiful. No, not like that. I'm married. Like the first thing she tells her.
The scene where she fucking gets dragged up in all Elaine's shit is the most trans feminine woman, cis woman scene I've seen. Well,
yeah, she's a drag queen.
And a close second is when immediately after that they start wrestling.
Yeah. That's the trans lesbians.
But once again, I think, was that
poor gay Trish?
But was is it a limitation? Like, was this film intended to be queer? I'm now wondering.
I think what it was intended to be is lesbian in the political sense.
Huh.
Can you go on about that?
Homosocial rather than homosexual.
Broadly speaking, so political lesbianism is sort of ill-defined, but it was again, second wave feminist-ish kind of movement. And it was saying that, number one, you don't need to sort of be into women to be a lesbian, but it was saying it was a lesbian separatist kind of thing where all women should be in principle lesbians, in that you associate with women, you make all of your, you know, personal relationships and friendships with women, you make a form of matriarchy, which is broadly sort of stupid.
It's very turfy as well, because the people who go down that line line than the fine womanhood truth.
And, you know, also, you can't have man on the land.
It's also, from what I understand, it's not only very turfy, but from it also tends to be very white.
Yeah, oh, overwhelmingly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think what you have to remember about people who were really into feminism in like the 70s is that there was other shit happening. Like, if you're really into feminism and not civil rights, there's something going on there.
Yeah, and I think that watching this film, I really loved it, but I think you're exposing a lot of stuff about its behind the scenes that are making me quite disappointed, because I read this as a camp film and a very gay film, but it sounds like all of those things were absolutely not intended.
It's camp. Don't worry, love. We still have Dracula Dead and loving it.
Oh,
it's absolutely camp, but it's in the Sontag sense of trying to do something highly refined and landing in stupid.
But like, I think that this is where we have the separating the art from the artist issue, because there is a good film in here without needing to like rewrite the text.
Yeah.
Some things will need to be rewritten, like some of the gay subtext should be more explicit, but there is a good film in here. Just it's not what the filmmakers intended.
It's not really escape
the hands. I think the art and artist problem is solved by this film.
Yeah.
I think the fact that, you know, I don't know the person, I've not seen any of her other work, I also don't know much about her own personal beliefs, but I think from what I understand, her failure to communicate what she wanted from this film allows you to take the film on its own.
But that's of the author more so than separation of the art from the artist.
Well, exactly, but this film, because there is such a distance between why people still really like it and how it was intended to be received, means that you can enjoy it even if you have problems with the director.
I kind of fucking enjoyed it, I gotta be honest.
I enjoyed it too. I think it's a really well made and interesting film. I think that
the central thesis,
a bit reductive, is also something I generally agree with.
Yeah, I think taking it as separate from the sort of thematic, narrative, ideological content of the film, as a sheer aesthetic achievement, this is insane.
Oh, it's fantastic. So much of it was done by Billa herself. Like, she wrote, produced, directed, but also was like the main production and costume designer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
the sound design in this film as well is brilliant.
Oh, completely.
And interestingly, part of the kind of mission statement of the film, in her own words, was the lavishness and the detail and the sort of stylized beauty of the production elements, because she said basically that she thinks there should be more lavish, detailed and stylish production elements and visual elements in films.
100% agree.
Well, and also
for the girlies.
And also filmed on 35mm, and it makes such a difference. Even if it wasn't for the, you know, outrageously fantastic set design and costumes, the fact that it is, and makeup, the fact that it's filmed and hair.
She got the fucking garage doors on. When do you see that these days? She got the monochrome big eyeshadow.
Oh, completely. But the fact that it is filmed in this using very retro technology as well, even if you took aside all the other things, it would still have a very tactile and retro feel.
They like to drink tea in this Victorian tea room, which in and of itself is amazing. And the pastel colors in that set are brilliant.
I have a theory that isn't backed up by any evidence about this. I wonder if her saying that it wasn't meant to be interpreted as camp or wasn't meant to be interpreted as funny is it's a prank. Because, like, I don't know how you make this film in which the entire aesthetic is 60s and 70s, but someone answers their iPhone and drives a very modern-looking BMW and not know that what you're doing is funny.
Has she made anything else since? Because I think that might answer her questions, because if whatever she makes after this is...
I think her most recent thing is a novel about the story of Bluebeard.
Oh, interesting. So once again, this proto-feminist...
Yeah, again, an extremely, like, 70s feminist thing to retell.
Because I'm curious to see, like, if she makes more films, if the next thing she makes is an upping and an exacerbation of the things that we like about it, you know, maybe those things were intended, but if it's almost a reaction to the audience reaction to this film by upping the fears that we have about her personal views and her personal agenda, then it might go the other direction. So I think that's my worry and that's my disappointment. It's not something that ruins this film for me, because I think I can still find a lot of improvement from this.
I think
but I'm a bit watching. Disappointed if what she makes after this is informed by her less than agreeable tendencies.
Which, to be fair, I don't know the total ins and outs of, but I do think that the sort of the messiness of the behind the scenes of this film does sort of add to the messiness of the narrative. The fact that this is a character whose ideology is extremely flawed and extremely skewed. There is something almost poetic about the fact that it's made by someone who seems to have complicated
views. Kind of batshit, yeah.
Your question. The only other full-length film I can find is a film from 2007 called Viva, in which Anna Biller writes, directs, and stars. It's a sex comedy about housewives seeking kicks in a world of swingers, orgies, booze, and sin. So it's clearly concerned with the same sort of critique of the so-called sexual revolution.
But this one is explicitly a comedy.
Yes.
Okay. Well.
But then again, you say Wikipedia, I don't know if she meant it to be a comedy. that's my point. And I want to look more into it. And I would say that despite all the flaws, that I would genuinely recommend everyone checks it out and makes up their own mind, because it is such, if nothing else, such a visual treat, but also it is a really interesting conversation, and it raises a lot of questions, even if you don't like the film's answers.
Well, even if the film didn't intend to raise those questions in the first place.
But
and
it's a really interesting film to talk about. I would say one of the more interesting films that I've brought on on this podcast.
Probably the most interesting film that you brought on.
A lot of them are really shit.
Yeah.
I'm bad at this. I hate
Speaking of which... If you can find some trans writing about this film, I suggest you read it, because I think it's not even just for a puritanical, like, know what to think about this film way. I think it really benefits from trans reading and trans feminist views. There's quite a good article by someone called Sam B on Medium called I Am His Fantasy on Anna Biller's The Love Witch, and that's coming from perspective of being a trans woman and a former cam girl, which really spoke to me. I thought it was great, and I think there's a lot to love here, not just ironically. I think it's rich, even if it's wrong about a lot, you know?
There's an article I shout out, I think. We're going to keep this off mic because I already mentioned it in another episode, but it's on the episode that you listened to, I think, about the importance of having, like, bad trans objects in a way, like the history of trans media almost like being reappropriated, but you know, in a series of films that
we'll get into this when we do Silence of the Lambs.
I thought you were about to say when we drew Dracula, and I was like, what? Oh, Silence of the Lambs is a great example of that. But yeah, we can talk availability now.
To be honest, we only brought Lydia on so that the first film we asked her to talk about wasn't Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
That's not a joke. I've actually said this to Lydia. I think it would be weird to do that film and not have a trans guest on.
Yeah.
Well, if the guests themselves are the ones who want to do it, then like Siobhan always tells us, I want to be there when you make a film about black people. And we're like, we don't want to tokenize you, but like, he's the one who keeps offering to talk about these films about blackness.
I'll come on for The Matrix. I'll come on for...
There you go.
Yeah, a film that is also about trans. But I told you, I promise you, we will never cover The Danish Girl.
Yeah, no. Don't
it's like, who cares about that film?
It changed cinema.
Yeah.
It opened the door for Tom Hooper to make Cats. Arguably a better trans film than The Danish Girl.
Well, it's more of a transhumanist film than a transgender film. Trans species film.
That was the last film I saw in cinemas before the fucking pandemic.
Yeah, it was December 2019.
The last one I saw before the pandemic was either Little Women or The Personal History of David Copperfield.
Mm.
Both of which, a rollicking good time.
Oh, I know which one was mine. Was Bacurau, the Brazilian film.
All right. Yeah. Fucking hipster. I love you, but fuck off. All right. You can rent this movie on Apple TV, Google Play, Microsoft, YouTube, and Sky Store, and Rakuten TV.
Which proves it's a good film.
Yeah, Rakuten TV only. See, Lydia, it's a good film because it's on Rakuten.
Of course. Yeah.
And you can buy it on all those channels as well. Let's crack on.
Children of the Night. Shall we move on to the next film?
Okay. Yes, Master.
Ah! Vampires do exist. This one we face is unlike any other. He can change the most innocent of humans.
Oh, Jonathan, let me kiss you.
But Lucy, I'm British.
So are these.
His evil desire has no end.
She's alive?
She's Nosferatu.
She's Italian?
When Renfield, a lawyer, shows up at the vampire Count Dracula's doorstep, he falls prey to his charms and joins him in his search for fresh blood. Enter Professor Van Helsing, who may be the only one able to vanquish the Count. That's it.
So that's the synopsis for Dracula, but would you care to tell us which Dracula film this is?
And include the year and the director.
Yes, this is Dracula, Dead and Loving It, 1995, directed by Mel Brooks.
So not the Dracula film people were thinking about when they heard the synopsis.
No, a much worse one.
I actually found this film really funny. I have the sense of humor of a 12-year-old. I'm not afraid to admit it.
I mean, do you know
Lydia,
what?
Why don't you tell us why you chose this?
You know, I'm almost tempted to say it was just a prank. It wasn't, though. It was just
It was an Annabella-style prank.
Yeah, it was a prank, guys. I made it up all along. No, well, so this is a film from around the same time period as The Mummy. It's a film that, like The Mummy, is interested in reinterpreting for a 90s general audience the classic films of Universal of the 1930s horror stuff. And although I didn't realize this until today, it is also a film made by Mel Brooks before a sort of 20-year career dip slash end that may be ending now that he's in something with his name on it doing History of the World Part 2 literally this year. And I was drawn to it because I think our personal history with this film is fairly similar, Charlie, in that I had this on VHS when I was a very young child, and I watched it when I was a very, very young child, and I remembered almost nothing of this film when I picked it. I just thought, oh, that would be interesting to take another look at. What I remembered specifically from this film was the staking scene and the scene where Peter McNichol as Renfield is just fucking eating insects left and right.
Which are the best scenes in the film.
Yeah, and do you know how I know that? Is because A, they were the only two I remembered, and B, we'd been planning this episode for a minute, so I got my hands on Mel Brooks' autobiography, didn't read the whole thing, but there is a chapter in it for this film, like every one of his projects, that is about 10 pages long and almost entirely by length is just a script of those two scenes. Dude, so he knows they're the only two things about the film that are worth anything as well.
I'd wager the best scene in this film is the whole sequence, which includes the line, "I'm gonna show you the boundaries of sexual depravity," and he replies, "But I'm British."
Yeah, that was a good one.
I thought this film was really funny. I love that you liked it. I was very tired when I watched it. My brain couldn't really process any, you know, highbrow, smart, clever comedy.
I had kind of a similar experience in that I watched it once to like see if it was worth talking about a while ago, and I was like, yeah, okay, I mean, I think there's stuff to think about in there. And then I watched it once this morning after watching the other three films almost back to back yesterday and after, you know, thinking very hard about all of that shit, he just put this on for an hour and a half or whatever, watching Peter McNichol be a right dickhead and a weird little fruit for like 2 hours.
I think that, okay, what you described with Dracula Dead and Loving It isn't really my experience with the film. I saw it when I was a teenager rather than when I was very young. What you're describing is more my relationship with Robin Hood Men in Tights. Which is possibly my favourite Mel Brooks film, even though I don't necessarily think it's his best. One thing I will say is that how Francesco described the reasons why he enjoyed it, in that he wasn't ready for anything that's particularly highbrow or intelligent. And I love Mel Brooks to bits. I'm a huge fan of his. That's not really any of his films.
No.
He's not really concerned with that. He's concerned with just getting the laugh. And that's what makes him great. But it's also kind of what makes this movie a bit frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I think that what my interpretation of this film, to compare it again to Robin Hood Men in Tights, and also to The Mummy, the way that The Mummy is sort of a combination of Indiana Jones and the Universal 1930s Mummy movie, and the way that Men in Tights is a comedic clash between the Errol Flynn Robin Hood and the Kevin Costner Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, I think this is trying to do, or at least conceptually started as, what if we combine the Bela Lugosi Dracula with the Francis Ford Coppola Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Yeah, which there's a lot of visual references to.
There's a lot of visual references, but the story doesn't actually do anything with.
I think that's one of its problems. The story doesn't really depart from Dracula at all.
Especially the 1930s one of it, because like Renfield being the guy that goes to Transylvania and not Jonathan is a huge departure from the book that the 1930s film makes, and this film does. And I'm not quite sure what this film thinks its central joke is, other than Leslie Nielsen is Dracula.
Yeah, that's the thing is most of Mel Brooks's films are parody or pastiche broadly.
Yeah, or burlesque.
Yeah, yeah. But
his most famous film is arguably Young Frankenstein, where he's
which would have been a very good pick this week.
It's a string of Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, and arguably Spaceballs as these, generation defining parodies.
Yeah, but Young Frankenstein specifically being about a universal horror movie.
Yeah, exactly. And arguably that is the better version of this film, but it's far too well known to really qualify as an alternate for this episode.
Can I tell you where this film actually started, or where at least the story for this film started?
Absolutely.
I did some research.
I love it.
By which I mean I read the internet.
All of it?
The whole thing.
All of it, yeah.
You are now 99% data.
Steve Haberman and Rita Luca were co-story and co-writing credits with Brooks on this film. They were writing a different film that was a serious horror sci-fi film, and found that they kept putting jokes in the film, and to avoid putting jokes in that film, they wrote this film a comedy, so that they got all the comedy energy out while writing their other film that they cared about more.
So it was mostly recycled jokes that were meant for a different film, or
which explains why none of the jokes are funny.
You are wrong.
And I think that really shows up. Like, it doesn't feel like a film made completely on purpose.
No. You know? But what's very frustrating about it is, if you said Dracula directed by Mel Brooks, that sounds like a slam dunk.
Yeah.
Like, but at the same time, a lot of the jokes that are tropey of Universal monster movies are already done in Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Which also isn't just a Mel Brooks film. You have that brilliant collaboration between him and Gene Wilder, which you don't get in this. And I don't think Leslie Nielsen, even though I really like him and find him really funny in other films, he's not the same sort of creative partner that sometimes Mel Brooks needs.
And it's not quite the same sort of comedy. It's similar, but Mel Brooks' characters usually know there's something funny going on, at least to an extent.
Whereas there's usually like a wise
Leslie
guy.
Nielsen was, whereas the point of Leslie Nielsen from Airplane onwards was that he was a serious actor.
Yes.
And, as much as he mostly was known for comedy after that, the comedy he was known for was because of how serious he was being in silly situations.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone's silly in this film.
but arguably you also have the same problem with Peter McNichol, who is also really funny when he can go big, but his characters, I think of him as, Sophie's Choice, which is obviously such a serious role, but also he plays the uncle in Veep, and that's hilarious, but the reason why it's funny is because it's also, as well as being so big, it's so threatening.
And speak for yourself, Sophie's Choice was a riot. Funniest films I've ever seen. But that's why I think one of the funniest scenes in this film is where Dracula is mind controlling two women at the same time and giving them directions. Yeah. And the one that he wants to give directions to is never the one who listens. Like, I don't know. Like that. I think that's a scene where Leslie Nielsen's seriousness works because he gets frustrated over it.
And that's the thing is, I think there are the bones of a really good film in here.
Yeah.
And it's just done so poorly. And just the moment-to-moment stuff, the timing, the little things are all slightly off.
Also, the fact that, to go back to, like, Young Frankenstein looks like a Universal horror movie.
Yeah.
Blazing Saddles looks like a Western. This looks like a
90s comedy. Yeah.
And weirdly, they
were going to shoot in black and white, and they decided, well, no, let's do it in colour, because a lot of the famous Dracula films were the Hammer horror ones, and they were in colour.
If they did it as a parody of the Hammer Dracula, that would be a more original take than the sort of confused combination of the 90s Dracula and the 30s one.
And I think it explains a lot of the painted backgrounds that if it were in black and white, wouldn't look, you know, as...
But like, again, not to harp on about the Coppola Dracula, but the thing that I think makes that film work is how beautiful it looks. And so if you're doing it in colour and you have a lot of visual references to the Coppola Dracula, people are going to be thinking of that and it will just look ugly.
Yeah.
I don't hate this film at all. I think it's interesting and I'm really glad we get to talk about it.
I don't know.
It's incredibly frustrating.
It is frustrating because, again, like I said, if you said Dracula, Mel Brooks, Leslie Nielsen, like,
quality.
It makes sense on paper, but it's fumbled so badly, in my opinion.
Yeah.
That makes it kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, like, you know?
There's that scene where Dracula is visiting Renfield in the asylum and it's like hanging upside down from the window and it's trying to talk to him and Renfield goes like, wait, and he just does a handstand to like look him face to face. I thought that was so funny.
But there's, you know, but there's that scene after where he flies down from there and says, follow me, Renfield. And then he jumps and obviously can't fly. And like, okay, there you have a joke. A guy thinks he's a vampire. Yeah, and then the fact that he then says, no, I fly, you go down the drain pipe. It's like, no, but you have the joke.
Yeah.
You're not adding a punchline to the joke. And then
Renfield repeats, oh, that's right, I'm so stupid. He flies, I don't. He flies, I don't. He repeats that like three times.
I also don't think Peter McNichol is funny in this movie. He can be very funny, and I really I think he's very cloying and very annoying.
I might feel the way in this film, the way you feel about Rachel Weisz and The Mummy and vice versa. I think he's a little fruit and a freak and I love him.
I think his facial comedy in this film is outstanding.
Lydia, whereas Rachel Weisz, I'm just happy whenever a hot Jew comes on screen. I'm just grateful that we can contribute that to the world as a community. Yeah.
You know, people talk about so bad it's good films and enjoying films for how shit they are. And I think this is a separate category. This is so mid it's good. This is not quite bad, not like god-awful terrible, but not good. There's a mathematical principle, which is that there are no uninteresting numbers. Because if you count high enough to find a number that's not prime, not in any major sequences, blah, 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 and say, well, that number, that's not an interesting number, then that would be the first uninteresting number and be interesting by dint of that. And I think this is a film that's chiefly interesting for how nothing it is.
See, when films are so bad they're good, for me at least, it's because I sort of view them as earnest in their failure, that they reached for something and dropped the ball and didn't quite make it. Whereas this feels like
they were phoning it
lazy.
In. Yeah, feels like they weren't really trying.
Yeah, and I don't enjoy that even in bad films. The bad films I like, they're trying very hard. I mean, there's a reason why The Room has had so much staying power.
Yeah.
It's because...
Ed Wood's
films
have
had so much staying power is because the people making them genuinely
thought they were good. Yeah.
Whereas I don't believe that Mel Brooks thought this was a good film.
Yeah, I don't think anyone involved with this thought this is a very good film. And if they did, they were probably quickly disabused of that notion when it was a massive flop.
I thought it was a good film.
If we don't have anything else to say, and Lydia, as someone that doesn't think this film is good,
yeah,
why would you recommend this film to people who like The Mummy? In brief, give us your pitch to our audience.
I think it's an interesting contrast, and I think works of art aren't valuable only in making you feel some type of way. I think all works of art are worth knowing, even possibly especially failures. And this is an abject failure of the most miserable type, where not only did they not achieve anything, it doesn't really feel like they were trying to achieve anything. And yet, this is a film that got made, was shown in cinemas, and that I had on a VHS. This exists as part of a culture, part of a mass culture. It exists as part of the filmography of one of the most important directors, like, certainly of comedy and probably of anything.
So it's an inspirational
this
story.
It's worth remembering. Shit things are worth remembering. And I think this is a perfect example of how even when they're not, like, even when you're not finding some sort of outsider enjoyment of how shit something is, it's still got something to tell you.
Shit things are worth remembering, which is why all our nightmares are of being back at school.
Exactly.
The only thing I can think of adding to that is, you know, it's worth checking out if you're a Mel Brooks completionist,
yeah,
or a Dracula completionist.
That was a large part of the appeal for me, is
it's the
I
one really everyone like forgets.
Yeah.
Other than High Anxiety.
And the Chairs one.
12 Chairs is a great song, though. Mm. Hope for the best, expect the worst. That's my motto. It's also the motto of this podcast. Do you want anything to add to an appeal to the masses to reclaim Dracula Dead and Loving It, Francesco?
I thought it was a funny film. If you're not looking for anything too try hard,
such as jokes.
There's a scene where Van Helsing is teaching a class of medical students, saying, he's doing an autopsy and being like, this is where we separate the future doctors from, you know, the people who just faint. And then it just goes through an increasing series of gory things that are left off screen, and all the students just fall and faint one by one behind him. And I thought that was great visual comedy, if anything. It wasn't a particularly clever or interesting joke.
Here's why I think that scene does actually work really well for me, is because, as Lydia pointed out, there are very few moments in this film where a character is in on the joke in a way that works specifically for a Mel Brooks comedy. When it becomes clear that Van Helsing isn't trying to educate these people, he's actively trying to psych them out and make them faint, you realize, oh, this is someone who is trying to have fun.
Yeah, because then the nurse comes in and she's like, 10 out of 10, great job!
Yeah, but even before that, you can see, like, him getting more and more excited the more people faint. And I think that scene works because there is a central conflict, which is this guy is meant to be teaching, and this guy is so uninterested in teaching. All he's interested in doing is sort of big-dogging these young doctors.
That's what I think, like, maybe a lot of the script doesn't work, you're right. Like, a lot of the punchlines are milked way too hard, or are just treating the audience a bit, like, they're just a bit too on the nose. But the visual comedy and the physical comedy, you know, there's a reason why the scene where Renfield is eating bugs is so good, or the staking scene is so good, or the scene where he's mind controlling the two women, because those are primarily concerned with physical comedy.
Mm. Yeah, I do think that Leslie Nielsen, not just because sort of he's getting a bit long in the tooth by the time this movie comes out, it is a bad choice to play Dracula.
Mm. Yeah, he's not good at that.
I don't think he's... I think he'd be a good Dr. Seward, actually.
Mm.
I think that Dracula, here's kind of the problem, and it's sort of a problem I have with when Jim Carrey played Scrooge, is that, like, you can't really play these characters straight, and Leslie Nielsen is a great straight man and deadpan person, but Dracula is a ridiculous character.
Yeah.
And it's a ridiculous character is very hard to pastiche. There's a reason why in Young Frankenstein, the monster is basically the same as he is in the Universal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you got an actor that could sort of get the Bela Lugosi energy rather than the, you know, Leslie Nielsen just doing his thing.
Yeah.
who would you cast from the 90s?
From the 90s?
Because obviously Gene Wilder wasn't really available then, maybe. But...
Well, I don't think Gene Wilder would have been right either. Mm. Again, he could have been some other roles. He could have been quite a good Van Helsing. I think Mel Brooks is fine as Van Helsing. It depends which direction you went. I think Mel Brooks could have been a good Dracula.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And I think also if the thing is Dracula Dead and Loving It, we have to get the sense that Dracula is, you know, having fun. And I don't think Leslie Nielsen does that. I don't think that's what's asked of him. And I don't think that's his energy in this film.
But you're right. This film needed a sexy Dracula, but because they wanted to ape the Coppola aesthetic and having like an old looking white haired Dracula. They went with Leslie Nielsen, but that's not the Dracula that they wrote.
But also in the Coppola one, he gets younger. That's why you have the white haired one, so that it can be scary when he turns up. But because this Dracula is never scary, there's no... Again, the word I use for this film is frustrating.
Yeah.
It's got potential, though.
Yeah. And I like that Leslie Nielsen wanted to work with Mel Brooks. I just think he was either miscast and the film was miswritten.
Possibly both.
If you swap Nielsen and Brooks in their roles, I think the film would be better.
Yeah, yeah. A lot less is required of Van Helsing. He doesn't really tell jokes. He's just sort of...
I mean, you could give him some jokes.
Yeah.
But that's why Leslie Nielsen would have been good as a straight man in it.
Yeah, I mean, Leslie Nielsen had punchlines, but yeah, I get your point. All right, availability. That was a weird series of tangents that sort of coalesced in a episode.
None of the films had anything to do with The Mummy.
They did.
As much as they ever do. If you want to stream this film, you can't, because I don't think Mel Brooks wants you to.
Understandably. But that's why you should.
You can buy a DVD of it and VHS if you're a masochist.
Or it's split up in a series of 72 TikToks.
So that was Dracula Dead and Loving It, Francesco's favourite film.
You can find it in a skit.
On record, my favourite film of all time.
Francesco's favourite film of all time, Dracula Dead and Loving It.
Yes.
All right, Lydia, so the way we usually end the episodes is we ask if the title film, in this case, 1999's The Mummy, is the main course, which of our three alternates is dessert?
Oh, I think it has to be Gods and Monsters. For me, I think that's got to be the pairing. And not because they're tonally similar, but because, you know, they're both sort of originating from the same place. And I think it's probably the closest in terms of, like, it's just a sort of entertaining movie. It's just a drama, not like a family comedy. Also, I just think it's the best one. I like it the most.
I genuinely think The Love Witch is my favourite of the three alternates, although, well, Dracula Dead and Loving It, it wasn't close. But Gods and Monsters, I think, does have those two performances which are spectacular. And I think if you really want to do a renaissance of Brendan Fraser, I think the way to go isn't just The Mummy and George of the Jungle. You need to watch this film.
Yes.
But I get I totally...
Batgirl, which doesn't exist. Very sadly. I've probably seen more of that film than anyone will, because I was here when they were filming it.
No, for me, I think if you're enjoying The Mummy as a gay man, then it's Gods and Monsters. As a gay woman, then it's The Love Witch. As a straight person either side, then it's Dracula. And if, like most fans of The Mummy, you're bi or pan. And if, like most fans of The Mummy, you're bi or pan, then take your pick.
Yeah, as per usual.
Fucking kill you both.
But no, the actual answer is, as dessert, Dracula, that they're loving it.
Fair enough.
Won't elaborate.
I think mine is Gods and Monsters, for the reasons Lydia gave. All right, so that brings to the end of the episode. Thank you so much, Lydia, for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. I'd love to come again.
As always, our producer is Jade Corbett. Our art is by Molecule. You can follow us on Twitter at @BCUWatchPod. You can follow us on Instagram at @BCUWatchPodcast. Thank you, Francesco.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening. And as always, we hate bugs.
We eat or we hate?
We hate bugs.
Well, I eat bugs.
Only when you're in your sarcophagus.
Yeah. I'm Ramfield, your lesson insulin.
I was Imhotep. Or Amidalili.
Oh, I was thinking Ramfield. Anyway, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Be careful. And only end the recording. Don't end the call.